October 2nd, 1977. My name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Major General George Kitching, who served with the Canadian Army during World War II. General Kitching, the last time we were talking, we were discussing various facets of Operation Totalize. The next operation was Operation Tractable on the 14th of August.
Yes, we Totalize ended really with a stalemate in that the 4th Armored Div ran up against the Quesnay Wood area that we mentioned last week. And the feeling was that an infantry division should then attack it. So I think it was the 3rd Canadian Division was brought up, brought forward, took over from us, and did an assault on Quesnay Wood by a brigade, and it failed. Quesnay Wood was very strongly held. And Guy Simmons, that would be about the 12th of August, 12th, 13th, and Guy then realized that he'd never get in that way. There was too much of a stopper there in the way of anti-tank weapons and also woods, which are in themselves are very difficult for infantry to operate through intelligently, unless it's a very well-planned operation. So he called off the dogs on that particular operation and instead lined everybody up for an operation called Tractable. And the trick about Tractable, was he was determined to use to achieve a breakthrough by the use of armored vehicles and armored personnel carriers. He didn't want to do it by night again because of the problem of air support and also the confusion that had developed on the morning after the night attack. So he changed it to Tractable, which was to be a daylight operation, but instead of darkness he put down smoke, very heavy smoke on the flanks, and light smoke, so-called light, in the center of the attack. And the attack was really to be made by two divisions, two armored, almost equivalent armored divisions, each with two brigades of infantry behind. And one of the infantry brigades in each was to be armored-borne, personnel carrier-borne, and the one right in rear was to march. And it was to start, if I remember, at 12 noon on the 14th. And the idea was to basically to get across initially a river called the Liaison. In fact, the river itself is about as wide as this room. It's about 12 feet. But and is not an obstacle in itself. But unfortunately, the banks dropping down to it are an obstacle, and they're very steep. It's what I think one would almost call a gully, heavily treed, and with these small Norman villages about every mile along it. So the idea was using armor together with every funny, as we call them, all the fascine-throwing tanks that carry these huge fascines of wood, and that belong to a British division called 79th Armored Division, which had all these so-called funnies in it. We had our full quota of these. They went with the leading tanks, and as soon as they came to any ditch or any obstacle, they went ahead and either bridged it with a bridge-laying tank, or they went ahead and dropped maybe 50 or more of these fascines into the ditch, and we just went across on the fascine. Tractable was really the planning of it, was brilliant, I think, by Corps headquarters. They only had a matter of hours to lay it on, and it was laid on well. And I think had it not been for the bombing by our own aircraft of parts of our own forces, it might have been a tremendous success. But unfortunately, in the case of 4th Armored Division, we were the left of the two divisions that did the run. I think about 2 o'clock, the Allied, there was no previous artillery used in this assault. Everything just suddenly hit the enemy with a crump, all smoke, and then crump. Unfortunately, the day before, an officer from, I think, the 2nd Canadian Division had been captured with the entire battle plan on him, including the air program, including the smoke program, so that the enemy knew we were coming, and they were able to reinforce. Now, if it hadn't been for that, and if it hadn't been for the fact that our own RCAF component of Bomber Command dropped 700-800 tons on us, I think it would have been a great success as a core operation. But those two factors had quite an impact. The bombing by our own air forces was unfortunate because it disrupted communications at a very critical time in what was then developing into a battle ahead. The armor had got across the liaison after really having to look for crossings. The crossings we thought would be available were not. And so certainly the armor in 4th Armored Division, the two armored regiments up, had to literally feel their way to the left, about a mile, 2 miles, before they could find a crossing. But they got across in the smoke and the confusion. And they got across to the other side and went fairly well. They got in about 2 or 3 miles beyond the Liaison River to a little town called Olandon. But unfortunately, at this critical period, which would be about between 1 and 2 o'clock, when they'd crossed the river and were beginning to move in, just when the bombers came down on our own communications and headquarters and so on, and my own headquarters was right in the middle of it. I had a small advanced headquarters, which was on a ridge overlooking the battle, which we could see about a mile to 2 miles ahead of us. And unfortunately, the bombs came down, and whilst none of my men were hurt, were wounded, everybody was a bit shaken up. We were all in little slit trenches that had been dug weeks before by the Boche. But what happened was it threw all the communications, our tanks, the wireless sets, the radio sets, went off kilter and had to all be, some had to be major repairs because, of course, they dropped heavy bombs and the impact was...
The concussion. The
concussion was terrific. But the worst thing, from a purely personal point of view, was that during this actual bombing, the Armored Brigade headquarters, Brigadier Booth, he got lost in the smoke, and instead of going straight ahead, which is the area that he was supposed to go straight into, follow his own troops, his own tanks, by this time the dust and the smoke really made it goddamn hard to see anything at all. As I say, we were a mile to 2 miles from the battle, and just occasionally through the murk and the dust and smoke, you could see the odd tank. You could see people firing. You could hear, of course, naturally hear the sound of it. Just at that moment, Booth and his headquarters, instead of going straight ahead, turned right, and they ran right into an anti-tank screen that Kurt Meyer, who commanded the troops in that area, had put up in order to block a move onto this famous Quesnay Wood area. So Boothie and his headquarters were knocked out. I forget how many tanks were destroyed in the run, but the important thing was Booth himself was mortally wounded. He wasn't killed outright, and his intelligence officer was severely wounded. The brigade major escaped, but he was alone. They put Booth into a jeep, tried to get him out, and as I think I mentioned one or two previous talks back, he was evacuated along the Liaison River and ended up in a Polish armored division aid post. And, of course, the problem of language, and nobody knew who the hell he was. He was very severely wounded, I think, with a leg and an arm gone. And he was wearing, of course, brigadier's badges, which in the Polish army just signify nothing. Most regiments wore the same little red tabs that brigadiers did. So, not that it would have affected the issue, he would have died anyway, but it really does to show the confusion.
Right.
Now, just when these tanks, the armoured regiments, had crossed the liaison and were going fairly well, they had reached their objectives, Olandon and another, Epoincy, I forget the name of a little town there, and at about that time, normally they would have received orders from their brigadier. Normally he would have been there. You know, he'd have gone up and said, "All right, fellas, well done. We'll go ahead on to the second phase," whatever it might have been. And of course they looked round for their boss. They didn't know he'd been killed, and nor did we, because of course all communication was dead. Mm-hmm. Our own communication had been thrown out by the bombing. I don't think I knew. I often try to look back on timing, but I don't think I knew that Boothie had been hit until about 5 o'clock. 2 or 3 hours after. I then, of course, we notified Corps, the Corps commander, and because he and I had an arrangement that if Boothie was killed, he would be replaced by Bob Monsell, who was on the staff. And I think it was about 5 o'clock, 5 or 6. Meanwhile, the brigade major, I'd gotten a hold of him as soon as we heard about this disaster, and he's a man called Jerry Chubb, who's still alive. He became a brigadier. Jerry tried to reorganize the headquarters, but he had very little to operate with, since most of what the brigade headquarters had been destroyed. So we souped him up a bit, but it really took a day to get reorganized again, 12 hours, through that night. And so, meanwhile, Colonel White, who commanded the Governor General's foot guards, an armored regiment, I appointed him to command the brigade. Well, poor fellow, the next morning, having been told to put everything together and command it, he had his foot blown off practically on a mine, so he was evacuated. He came past my headquarters and said, "I'm sorry, I can't even get out of the vehicle I'm in." He was in a white scout car, and because we went up in a mine, and so he went to hospital, and I put Bill Halpeny in. Well, it's a hell of a thing to have all these changes going on in the middle of probably the most hectic battle. Mm-hmm. Including Alamein. Everybody was converging on the Germans. Everybody was impatient as hell. Everybody was saying, "Get on, get on, get on." And it was really a very difficult, but tractable as an operation. Had it not been for these one or two unfortunate things, I think certainly if it hadn't been for the plan falling into the hands of the enemy, it would have been a superb operation. It would have gone extremely well. Well, tractable. It fizzled, like all plans. You reach your first or second objective, and then for various reasons you can't keep rolling and get the third. There's a reorganization required, and I think in the case of Corps, I think suddenly they were told to swing everybody to the left, because as soon as we had achieved the phases we felt we could achieve for tractable, Geisermann's switched. We were going ahead on one line of action to the west of the River Dive, which led towards the pocket where the enemy were. And suddenly, about 10 o'clock in the morning, he came up and told me to switch the whole center line from one side of the Dive to the other. So we went, I sent some people over to capture, make sure a bridge was still intact, which they captured. And then we then took off about 2 or 3 miles to the east, with a river in between, the east of where we were originally planned. But all this time, of course, there was a lot of confusion. A brand new brigade headquarters, an acting brigade commander, who was the third in 3 days, and incidentally, Bill Halpeny, I think he's alive, and I wouldn't like him to think that I didn't think highly of him. I thought very highly of him as a person. But Bill was a very quiet sort of person, and not the ideal, necessarily, for an armored brigade as the commander. But he is all I had left, because Worthington, Don Worthington of the BCR, the BC regiment, had been killed 4 days before. He would have been my natural choice. He had all that drive and energy that you would look for in a person like that. So the brigade, in a way, was leaderless. The armored brigade were leaderless. The units did damn well. I think if you read through the story, when we had our new line and we took off for Trun and Chambois and St. Lambert, the regiments did as well as anybody right and left of them. In fact, they got ahead, I think, even the Poles, and certainly ahead of the British on the right. But it's difficult, Jim, to sit back and for you to imagine the incredible tension that was being built up. Here were 175,000 Germans with maybe 5,000-7,000 vehicles, maybe 500 tanks, being slowly cornered, strangled. And Monty was as impatient as anybody. Crera was impatient. Simmons was impatient. I was impatient. Everybody was impatient. Everybody was shoving the other guy. And it's interesting, I noticed even in Charles Stacey's history, that you get a situation that Monty, after all, commanding an army group, that's almost like being God, you know, this is like being up in heaven, leans all the way down and starts telling Simmons what to do with the Polish armored division and what villages and towns it's to capture. Now this, it's almost like the principal of a school going down and into a classroom and telling the teacher in front of all the students, as it were, that 7 and 8 really don't make 15, or whatever the hell they make in new math, I don't know. But everybody was descending so many grades lower.
Violating the chain of command.
Violating, but not because they were bloody-minded, normally bloody-minded, but they became increasingly bloody-minded as the tension became tensions became greater. And into a pocket about, 3 miles by 4 at the end, we had the Polish armored division on the left. It was kind of half lost. You know, the Poles were very gallant soldiers, but logistically, they were absolutely hopeless. They were always running out of everything. They ran out of ammunition. They ran out of soldiers. So any German coming in, who was of Polish origin, they gave him a new name, new uniform. And he turned around and fought for us. That was their way of getting recruits, which incidentally was a good way because they fought well. But the Polish armored division, at that stage of the war, was almost a liability because the goddamn thing, language was the problem. And in the case of Normandy, they landed up, they fought very hard, and they went up on our left, and they ended up on a couple of hills and ran out of ammunition. And half the problem was to rescue the Poles, not kill the Germans. It was to get the Poles before the Germans got them, since they had so little ammunition. And I remember one night the RAF were flying in ammunition. It was a shocking night, raining like hell, and with a low cloud about 100 feet, you know, just over the tops of the trees, and they were trying to find the Poles and dumped thousands hundreds of tons of stuff to try and support them. Many of the aircraft pranged, of course, because they came in so low in order to try and spot the location. And we in 4th Canadian Armored Division, I was getting goddamn mad, frankly, at about this time. All the concern about Maciek and his Poles, when I had lots of problems going on in the division. We had the South Alberta Regiment at a place called St. Lambert, fighting like hell, trying to prevent the Boche breaking out or breaking through there, taking a lot of prisoners. That's where Dave Curry got his VC. We held Trun, and our people... I was given a brigade of the 3rd Division, I think John Rockings' brigade, Rockies. And John came up, and he'd just taken over the brigade, I think a few days before. And he said, "What can I do?" And I said, "John, all you can do really is get into that cauldron of thousands of soldiers. And when you see Germans, kill them. And when you see our people, don't." I mean, literally, that was the way it was. The square of killing was about 3 miles by four. And into this were pouring thousands of Germans. And on the edges of it, on one edge were the Poles, somewhat isolated. And then on the far edge, the Americans coming up. They weren't there then. And on, really, on almost two sides were our 4th Armored Division and then another Rockies 3rd Division and also another part of 3rd Division. And so to get something like, 3 or 4 Allied divisions, Canadian divisions or Polish, ringing about 50 to 100,000 men in, you could see them 400 yards away, trying to get through on hedges. They weren't shooting at you a hell of a lot, because poor devil, they wanted to get out. And all the time, there was the cry from Monty, you know, "Close the gap, don't let them get out." And the cry then, which I felt very strongly about, from our people to say, "For Christ's sake, we don't have any tanks left. We are down to so many tanks, 14 tanks in a regiment instead of 47. So when you know, tempers begin to get a bit frayed, and Guy Simmons started to give me instructions and orders that, in my opinion, we could not, under those conditions, carry out without a great deal of confusion and in my opinion, a loss of even more men and tanks. You can't stick your head in the darkness into a swarming mass of enemy. In my opinion, there was no point in doing it, because you're going to kill them anyway. And what the hell was the point of trying to close a gap of about a mile in the darkness, or even in daylight, because overhead were swarming our own aircraft, having an absolute heyday, and we had regiments of artillery were just firing in right, left, and center. They were just firing over open sights into this mass of Germans trying to get out. Occasionally, the odd German tank, 3 or 4 of them together, would try and make a break. You might get 1 or 2 of them. But I was told that I hadn't closed the gap. This was really the crux of the... And the gap, I was told that the people in St. Lambert and in Tran had not effectively stop the German getting through. Well, it's goddamn hard under those conditions to do it. And I could see, in a way, the writing on the wall. I knew Simmons. I'd known him, as I mentioned earlier. I knew him very well indeed, and I knew his temperament. And I knew that he was under the gun. I knew he was going to fire somebody. Charles Foulkes met me on the night of the 18th, which is 2 nights before I left Fort Duke. And Charles said, "George, I'm for the high jump. I'm getting fired. I know the old man, that's Guy, he's after somebody's blood, and I'm damn sure it's going to be mine." And Dan Spry had just joined that day. He'd flown back from Germany, from Italy, where he'd commanded a brigade to take over 3rd Division, which Rod Keller had commanded, and when Rod was wounded by our own bombers. And it's interesting, the three of us met, Foulkes, Spry and myself. We were all Royal Canadian Regiment, regular. And I remember Charles said, "Well, at no other time will one regiment produce the three divisional commanders here. Let's have a drink." So we had a drink. And it was after this that Charles said, "You know, George, I think I'm for the high jump." And Dan Spry laughed and said, "Well, I don't think I am, because I haven't done anything yet. I mean, this was the 18th. So there was a lot of excitement in the air, a lot of casualties being taken. Everybody seemed to assume that the breakout of the Germans was accompanied by almost no losses from our point of view. This is not true. We lost a hell of a lot of people. and tanks too. And it was the combination, really, of our own losses and the short tempers, I guess, that were beginning to cloud the issue, that eventually erupted into Guy sending for me and saying he decided to change the command. At the time, Harry Foster came up to take over that day. That within an hour, Harry was there. And I said to Guy, for Christ's sake, you get him in 1 hour to take over from me. But when Booty was killed, you waited 6 days before I got somebody. And you knew that my best regimental commander had been killed. You knew that White had had his foot blown off. So I'm reduced really to a fourth choice out of four. And I just, that was all I said. I think it's goddamn unfair, and that's that. And I told him that that we lost a lot more than he, I think, ever dreamed. I don't think Guy ever realized the number of vehicles and tanks we'd lost and the number of men, which is more important. When Harry Foster took over, I think I handed over to him. Harry had commanded 7th Brigade. He'd landed on D-Day. And he was an armored corps man, and I'd known him very well, and his brother had been in the Royal Canadian Regiment. And Harry came up and said, George, what the hell have you been up to? How in the hell did Guy get to fire you? So I said, I don't frankly know. I was bloody upset, mind you. I said, I was emotionally upset. I wasn't mad at Guy, I wasn't mad at myself, I was just mad at the way things developed. And I said to Harry, I think you'll be lucky if you get 35 runners in tanks right now out of 260 that we had 8 days ago. And I think Harry told me, or I heard subsequently, they got 46 runners out of 260. So with the destruction of the tanks, of course, goes the destruction of the crews. They weren't all dead by any means, but the tank would have a sprocket knocked out or something, and it would require replacement. And the crew might have been shaken up or wounded because of it. So you then have to reorganize a crew. It was looking back on it, it was an incredible battle to have taken part in, and I was very proud of it. And I think Foster did damn well. Unfortunately, the brigadiers concerned, the head gunner, Lane, was killed about 2 months later, blown up in a mine. Booty was killed, and Jim Jefferson, who commanded the infantry brigade for the whole of the 9 or 10 months of the northwestern European campaign, Jim lived here. He was an Edmontonian. He'd been in the Edmontons with me. Retired to Victoria, and I look forward very much to working with Jim to sort of put together the story. And he died last year. So it's difficult, because there are really not many of the regimental commanders still going. The Argyll and Sutherland commander, Dave Stewart, is, and he did extremely well with the regiment. In fact, when you look back, the individual regiments did a damn good job. And if you look on the map and see their objectives and what they accomplished, I think it was damn good. I think Jim Jefferson, commanding the infantry brigade, was superb, quiet but determined. And he wasn't frightened by anything, he just got on with his job. And I think the individual armoured regiments did extremely well too. I think the 27th, the Calgary regiment, the reconnaissance regiment, was commanded by Swati Wotherspoon, who's a Toronto family, did extremely well. Their squadrons fought with the infantry and 10th Brigade all through the piece. And it was Swati's Dave Curry that got the VC. And Swati Wotherspoon said to me, years after the actual battle, because I didn't see him before I left, he thanked me for not forcing them into further casualties. He knew what the form was. Everybody knew what the form was. And some heads had to roll, as Charles Stacey said. something had to give, and I'm glad that Simmons appeared to be satisfied with my head and nobody else's, because really there are no other heads to remove except Blackadder. He got rid of him, I guess, Ken Blackadder, who had a brigade. But as I said right at the beginning, Simmons was a great friend and is. Up to the time he died, he was a great friend, and I have many letters from him subsequently. Not in any way apologizing. Guy never apologized for anything, you know, because he, in his opinion, really made a mistake. But he was a very tough leader to follow, that's all. And as I mentioned earlier, he threatened to fire so many people. And told me about it because I was a great friend of his. He told me he was going to fire this, that fellow, folks, all sorts of guys. But at the last moment, he didn't, for some reason. Whether somebody pleaded for them, I don't know, but nobody pleaded for me. And when I went straight back to Army headquarters, and Harry Crerar was very kind. Church Mann was chief of staff. I went to see Church. I got back there, I guess, about 9 o'clock at night. And Churchman, the chief of staff, and I went to see him, and he said the army commander will be back around 10-ish, but he'll see you in the morning at 7:30, I think, before he goes off. So at 7 or 7:30, I went along to see him. And I sat in his trailer, in Harry Crerar's trailer, and he said, "George, you look tired." And I said, "I'm goddamn pooped. I've been asleep for about 4 nights." And he then said, "Well, I'm very sorry that it's come to this, and we'll look around and try and find a good job for you. But," he said, "I want you to know that the pressure has been on me just as much as it's been on you." He said, "Monty breathes down my neck the whole time. He's continually saying, 'Crerar, if you don't, you know, if you don't do this, that, and the other,' threats and implications of the..." And I think if you look back through the few quotes of Charles Stacy in his book, Victory Campaign, there was a lot of infighting caused by really the incredible mass of soldiers of armor that we had, all trying to converge on one point. Once that the breakthrough was achieved, the day after I left the division, everybody was turned loose. The enemy was finished, and we headed for the Seine, and everybody roared ahead. And the division really didn't see the enemy for some days. But it was leading to that tremendous crunch. That was the real. And believe you me, not only were tempers frayed, but I think there was a degree of confusion at that time, with a number of units and vehicles, crisscrossing each other, in order to try and close the gap. You know, if there was a spare unit somewhere, he was thrown in. And it was a very hectic period. It was the crux, really, of 60 days of war in Normandy. And it was very interesting. I talked to a couple of German generals who. One escaped and one was put in the bag by 4th Armored Div. I talked to them in 1960. Mm-hmm. And the one who was put in the bag said that there were about 7 or 8 generals, all trying to get out. They had, I think, two or three tanks, and they decided they'd all pile into these and take off. They were ordered to get out, senior officers, by the great man, Adolf. And so he said, which way would they go? And it was interesting because somebody said, "Well, let's avoid the Poles whatever we do, because if they hit us and they capture us, they'll shoot us straight like that without any sort of talk." So then they said, "Well, why not head south towards the Americans?" Well, apparently the consensus of opinion was the Americans were pretty slap-happy, trigger-happy, and they could just as likely shoot the guys, not knowing who the hell they were in the way of rank, as they would take them prisoner. Everybody was going like hell, and you didn't want prisoners. They were an embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Well, what about going for the Brits? In other words, going backwards, because the Brits were closing in from the west. No, because they hadn't got much food in England. And so the decision was to, the Canadians had the best food, and Canada was a nice country, and there were a lot of German prisoners that had been sent to Canada. So the decision was taken by these people to break through the Canadian line, and that's the way this man explained it. I must say, I laugh like hell to think the great decisions that had to be taken in the war, you know, based on food and the fact Canadians treated prisoners moderately well. It was very interesting to me to listen to these characters.
Well, certainly an important consideration.
Oh, it was for them, yeah, to get out. But it was, it's a funny sort of an appreciation to have to make. Seven generals wondering who the hell to surrender to, I think.
What position did you eventually...
Well, I went from there to a brigade in England called 13th Brigade, an unlucky number, but actually it was a good brigade. And it was really six infantry battalions that had been brought over from Canada and were being used entirely for training of personnel, of infantry. The training and retraining, because infantry reinforcements were running short, very short. And it was an extraordinary organization, frankly. The man who had it before me was Brigadier Macklin, who became Adjutant General, eventually, of the Canadian Army. Slim Macklin told me when I got there, he said, you'll hate what you see, because they're so short of infantry up at the sharp end that they are now more or less obliging sergeants from Ordnance, from Ordnance Corps, from the Rimi Corps, from all other Army Service Corps, sergeant majors, everybody are asked, please go and join the infantry. We'll send you up to Yorkshire, which is where the brigade was, in the northern part of England, and we'll give you a refresher course of 2 or 3 weeks, and then you'll become an infantry corporal. Well, you know, these are volunteers. These are people who joined, and unfortunately, many of these corps had many too many senior ranks. Yes, senior ranks, warrant officers and NCOs. Merely because the people whom they used to serve had all gone overseas, and they were more or less in static establishments. But they were damn good men. They had 3 years of training in a particular corps, 3 or 4 years. They had reached, many of them, sergeant major rank. And one morning, this was a disgraceful position to be in, to put us in at the far end. One morning, Fred Reeser, who was my brigade major, who was another Loyal Edmonton 49er, went down to meet a train at York, and where these fellows were detrained on their way to us. And he came back with a sergeant major whose name has gone completely from my memory. Hell of a nice man. And Fred said, I'd like you to listen to this man's story. So I listened, and he, with 32 other warrant officers, you know, sergeant majors, had been put on a train, and on their way had been told, you're now sergeants or corporals in the infantry. And you're going up to York so that you can become infantrymen and head overseas, head into reinforcements. Well, this particular sergeant major, whose name I've forgotten, I said, look, go and tell your fellows to put their badges back up again, as far as I'm concerned. You're going back on the next train to Aldershot, where you came from. And I phoned this man Macklin, who had the brigade before, and meanwhile moved to be chief of staff at Canadian Military Headquarters in London. And Slim Macklin, I phoned him and said, Slim, I'm not going to take those fellas. You cannot do this to people. So he said, I couldn't agree more. So I went down, and he and I went then to see Ham Roberts, General Roberts, who was commanding reinforcements, and from whose organization these people had come. And, well, it was all right. We unscrambled it. But they were just 32 of many, many very unhappy people who were given 10 days to 2 weeks, 3 weeks in some cases, to be trained as infantry and then put into the slaughterhouse, literally. And I got at about this time, Price Montague was head of the Canadian Military Headquarters in London, General Montague. And he phoned me and said that he'd like me to certify on every one of these soldiers, before they left the brigade, I had to certify that they were qualified infantrymen. And I said, no, they're not. You can't qualify an infantryman in 10 days or 2 weeks, for Christ's sake. you send them up here and give them 3 months, and we'll do our very best, and you'll get a fellow who knows the back end of a weapon from the other. But to get a fellow up and in 10 working days of Yorkshire weather, when it was raining practically almost every day continually, so that you're really in the worst form, the worst the worst possible conditions in which to retrain these people. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't sign any. I refused. But, of course, at the end of 2 or 3 weeks, you said to the fellow, we think you're trained. And he had every right not to go if he didn't want to go. But God bless them, most of them went. But as volunteers, they didn't, you know, they could come home. They signed on for, as ordnance. But God bless them, most of them, or I'm a service corps worker, was, they fought. Some did extremely well when they got to Europe. Some, unfortunately, didn't, because they were really not skilled. And this is one of the great tragedies that is brought out, I think, in this reinforcement problem. So that brigade I had for a period of only 5 weeks, and then I went to Italy to be chief of staff of 1st Canadian Corps, which I had left in February, really, of the same year. I'd left there commanding a brigade in 1st Corps, and I went back as chief of staff. That was an interesting period, but I think probably... is there much left on the tape, or is it worth... No, it's probably not.
Why were you... 5 weeks seems a short time to be with the 13th.
I don't think, frankly, I don't... I think 13th Brigade folded a few weeks after, because I think it was just the wrong way to produce infantrymen.
Well, this brigade was...
It was really...
Specifically set up?
Set up to retrain. It was a training brigade.
Oh, I see.
And it had the Rocky Mountain Rangers, which is an infantry battalion from BC, was one of the units. Now, they came over as a regiment. They went over as a regiment to Britain. And then many of their men became reinforcements for other units. They became a reinforcement training organization. So they trained infantrymen as well as these other fellows who came from other corps. Each of these 6 battalions in the brigade, it was a very strong brigade, was really a training organization. There was a French-speaking regiment, the Régiment de Saint-Hyacinthe, that trained the French-speaking people. Mm. And the Rocky Mountain Rangers is another, and one of London Fusiliers from London, Ontario. They were very good units, and they had good officers, of course, because they had been mostly at home, or that had 3 or 4 years of training. So they were good at training people. But what I objected to is this business of telling a fellow who'd volunteered for the Army Service Corps that suddenly he was now not wanted by the Army Service Corps, and pleased he would be an infantryman, and in 2 weeks he'd be in action fighting as a corporal. And I think this to me was just... No.
It does seem... But people, there were sufficient numbers of people that would volunteer to do this, to form a...
Well, really, I think they wanted to get into action, you know, and they knew they hadn't hope in hell of getting in as a corporal or as a sergeant or a sergeant major in their own unit. Mm-hmm. They knew there was no hope, and the only way they could get over was to volunteer for infantry.
But
a lot of them went.
Well, how large proportion of the members of 13th Brigade would fit that category?
Oh, don't forget, they only came to us for
3 weeks.
2 weeks, 3 weeks training. Oh, no. The great majority of the people we had, 90%, were infantry. But the one, and they came from all over the place. They were just being retrained. There were people who had gone off and become cooks or batmen or something and were lost in this great organization in Aldershot called Reinforcements, and which I think that, if I remember, had something like 25,000 people in it when people were howling for infantry in Europe. There were the this large number of soldiers. So on paper it looked good, but it was the way it was done. I think if somebody had gone down and said, look, fellas, we really need infantry very badly. Will you do it? But I think to be put on a train and told to take your rank off on the way up and put up some other rank without really having the thing explained was just, to me, a thoroughly undemocratic... So we sent them all back. And they, I think some of them may well have volunteered and come back up again after I'd gone. I don't know.
Just briefly, a couple of minutes we have left, what sort of training were these given? Were all the people... This reclassification was about 3 weeks for everybody?
Well, it depended very much on the individual. Some people that came up had some infantry training before, obviously. Mm-hmm. You could talk to the fellow, and he'd say, I feel pretty good. He knew how to pull a grenade pin. He knew what to do with it. He could recognize the direction from which fire was coming. We used to have, put them out on exercises and shoot at them. The bullets going just off to one side, but trying to detect the enemy so that they in turn could shoot back at him, although they didn't, of course, shoot back. And they were firing their different weapons, rifles, machine guns, Bren guns, everything, Sten guns, anything. And once a fellow had gone through and fired several hundred rounds of these through these different weapons, he was considered to be probably as good as the guy up front. And as long as he knew when to dodge when he got in, he'd survive and be a hell of a good soldier. It's the first 24 hours that is the killer. Mm-hmm. But they mostly joined sections or platoons, but that had got men that had been in action some while. And of course, they just watched them, and when they went down too. When they got up, and gradually, you within 24 hours, if you're still alive and kicking, you qualify as an old soldier because you probably survived.
Well, I think.
All right. Well, next time we'll go on from there.